Please would you turn back with me to Psalm 25. Psalm 25. Probably do not need to tell anybody that if you listen to somebody's conversation for long enough, if you're either speaking to them or listening to them speak to somebody else, you will very quickly begin to learn what is uppermost in their mind. There'll be concentration and there will be repetition. The things that we're engaged with, the things that we're bothered about, the things that we're concerned for, the things that we're excited over, that's what comes up again and again in our conversations. Our chief needs, our particular concerns, the things that we zero in on, that's what tends to come to the surface very quickly in our conversation. Sometimes preachers give to children those tick lists, don't they, with the certain words, vocabulary that's likely to be used in the sermon. And they're typically choosing the words that they imagine that they're going to be using a great deal. And perhaps you even know the ever played office bingo or buzzword bingo? This is something that they often do in industry, whether it's civil service, they have their own versions. Engineering will have its own versions. If you're in some kind of consultancy, all you do is you wait to go into a meeting and you've got a sheet of paper, and on it there are certain words or phrases, and you know what they're going to be. And all you need to do is put a tick in the box or cross them off as you go. And if you're really unfortunate, you forget yourself and shout bingo in the middle of a meeting when you've hit all the words that you always know are going to roll off somebody's tongue. And we could probably play buzzword bingo with some of our friends here, couldn't we? If you speak to me, you could probably say, I know a few of the words that are going to come up. If I'm speaking to you, I'm pretty confident that I can plot what will be in our conversation. For many people, it's health. You think about the proverbial conversation by the photocopier in a place of work. And there'll be somebody who comes along and you know that before very long they're going to be talking about the pain in their knee, the muscle that they pulled in their ear, the joint that they're struggling with, the strain in their belly button, whatever it may be. That's what's going to obsess them. They're always going to talk about how sick they are, and they love to know how sick you are. For some people it's their home. They always want to tell you about the new home that they've got, or the home that they'd like to buy, or the decoration that they've got, or the furniture that they're moving in. Other people, it's money, perhaps the latest get-rich-quick scheme, or what they've bought, or what they've spent, or how hard life is because they haven't got quite enough. Other people are obsessed about their jobs, so taken up with their work. This is all that they can think about. It's become almost an idol to them. Perhaps at school, maybe at particular times, it's either that teacher, or it's those grades, or it's that kid. And for a while, perhaps, you've got tunnel vision, as it were, and all you can talk about is what's happening at school. For some people, it's relationships. Obsessed about this boy or that girl, about being married or not married. For others, it's sports. You just flick the switch, and whether it's Manchester United or Tottenham or Chelsea or Arsenal or Liverpool, I mean, how many thousands of column inches, whether on print or on the screen, over the European Super League? It's obsessed people. It's all they want to talk about. Why? Because it involves their idols. It involves that which dominates their thinking and their feeling. It's why you've even got this so-called Arsenal lost at home syndrome. When things go badly for some men's teams, and it does typically tend to be the men, the incidents of domestic violence can rise. Incidents of suicide can rise. Why? Because everything hangs upon that team, and that's all that we think about. Or maybe it's your hobbies. Doesn't take long to turn you on to what you like to do in your spare time. Or maybe it's your reputation of people who are constantly obsessed about how they are perceived by others. Of course, I'm not bothered about myself, of course. I just can't help constantly being dominated by how other people perceive me. For somebody who's not bothered about how other people perceive you, you certainly seem to tell me a great deal about how you're afraid that other people aren't perceiving you in the way that you would like. And we're all like it, for better or for worse. Our primary concerns bubble up in our conversation. Now, with that in mind, consider Psalm 25. What bubbles to the surface as David speaks? What is his great concern in Psalm 25? What does he return to again and again? What is the themes that run throughout this psalm? To you, O Lord, I lift up my soul. O my God, I trust in you. Let me not be ashamed. Let not my enemies triumph over me. Indeed, let no one who waits on you be ashamed. Let those be ashamed who deal treacherously without cause. We could keep going through the whole thing, but notice how David, at the beginning and the end of this psalm, returns to the same theme. Verse 20, keep my soul and deliver me. Let me not be ashamed, for I put my trust in you. Let integrity and uprightness preserve me, for I wait for you. Redeem Israel, O God, out of all their troubles. At this point in David's history, as he writes this psalm, and it doesn't seem to be a psalm of panic, doesn't seem to be a psalm of terror, but it's a psalm of sober contemplation. What is David's chief concern is his soul. Now, there are many other things that David may have been taken up with, many other pressures that he might have faced. But what David thinks about first and foremost here is his soul in relation to God. And the language here means his very life, his being, his existence, his true self. And he fears that there is a danger that he will be lost or undone or overwhelmed in a particular sense. And because of those dangers, David wants help. If you were on a sinking ship, would you stop for a conversation about your health? Well, I suppose in one sense the conversation you might have would have reference to your health, but you wouldn't stop to tell somebody that you had a little ache or a pain, or even that you were suffering from some chronic condition. You probably wouldn't start discussing your home, your wealth, your bank account, whether or not you're winning or losing. That wouldn't matter so much. Your job, your grades, your relationships, the sports and the hobbies that so often obsess us. What should someone be concerned about on a sinking ship? Where are the life belts? Where's my life preserver? Where's the life saver? I don't know what you're like. I think it's preparedness. Maybe some people think it's paranoia. I know where fire exits are in buildings. Maybe it's part of the training I've had over the past, but my wife makes fun of me sometimes because of where I sit. I choose to sit. I know where the fire exits are. Why? If there's a problem, I know how to get out. When I go onto a ferry, especially some of you know, you've seen the photos of travelling on a ferry in the Philippines, and then you find out after you've got on the ferry just how many of those things sink over the course of a year. You are absolutely sure you are going to find out where the life belts are on that boat before it's left harbour. You want to know how to be safe. David is concerned about the preservation of his life because he is in a sinking world and he is under great distress. He is a believer and he's a vibrant believer. He's a man who is seen and known to be following God. David has a reputation as one of God's men, and that from the very beginning. He stands forth unashamed on that level as one who follows after Jesus Christ. And brothers and sisters, that is how we ought to be. Unashamed of our attachment to the Lord Jesus. Not trying to hide our way through this world. Not hoping that too many people won't find out. Not just calling it, I go to church. But making clear that we follow Jesus Christ. And that's going to make a difference to the way that we speak and the way that we think and the way that we live and the decisions that we make. And that provokes anger. That provokes opposition. That provokes tension. David is a godly man in an ungodly world. He's a believer making his difficult way through a dangerous environment. And as he does that, his chief concern is that he should find a life saver. Keep my soul and deliver me. Let me not be ashamed, for I put my trust in you. This salvation then, this preservation of the soul, this deliverance of the life has here these twin aspects. Keep my soul and deliver me. And then there's a dreadful alternative. Let me not be ashamed. And then there's a sure foundation. For I put my trust in you. And if we are believers, and I should say perhaps especially if you are not this morning, then this ought to be your first concern. Keep my soul and deliver me. Let me not be ashamed, for I put my trust in you. Here then are those twin aspects of this preservation. Keep me and deliver me. It's the language of a man who expects and experiences many trials and troubles and threats. And again, it is as a believer. And many of us are aware that in addition to the regular troubles that there are in a fallen world, the antagonism that comes against us because we are believers can be direct and deliberate and intense. Sometimes it seems almost just very general. If you've been knocking on the doors, if you've been preaching on the streets, if you're handing out tracts to people when we've gone out into the open air, you find just this antagonism that erupts before you've even begun a conversation. You knock on the door and you say that you're so-and-so and you've come from the church and you'd like to... And there's an eruption before you've even begin. And you sort of take a couple of steps back to show that you're not trying to cause trouble. But you try and press the point. And you're like, why are you so angry? I'm not angry! Well, you say, what is it that has provoked you? And for some people, it's the very thought of God. For some people, it's the very idea that there should be a God ruling in the earth. They seem to have this built-in antagonism against the church, and the mere mention of faith provokes a reaction of some kind. There are others for whom it's even more deliberate. Those who want to bring down the church of Jesus Christ. Those who are trying to dismantle everything that is the inheritance of a more Christian past in our society, bringing it down by degrees, whether it's freedom to worship, or the right to speak God's truth, or the identity of maleness and femaleness, man and woman made in the image of God, marriage as a God-given institution, and these things make people angry. But it comes close to home too. You may have friends, family members, and you know that when it comes to things spiritual, you are walking on eggshells around them. You only need to say what they consider to be the wrong thing. And they're primed. Perhaps they've even tried to get you trained. If you cross borders, then they will be angry. Angry is a great weapon for training conversations, isn't it? If you say that, I'll get angry and you'll have to back off, so you'll have to shut up. That's how we often control conversations. There are people who are very quick then to jump on any mention of, well, you always say that, or, well, we're not having that conversation, or it's not polite to talk about religion in this context. Perhaps some of us have been physically threatened. We felt endangered. David was profoundly conscious that he is surrounded by people who hate him. They've got no real reason for doing so, but they are against him because he is for God, and their heart is directed against him. And so he's praying here, keep me and deliver me. Keep me is the same language as you find at the beginning of Psalm 16. Preserve me, O God, for in you I put my trust. You see, even outside of this psalm, this is one of David's primary concerns. This bubbles to the surface. Guard me, preserve me. Why does a man pray like this? Why does a believing woman ask God to keep or guard or preserve us? It's because we know our own weakness and our own folly. I can't keep myself. I don't always see the way. I'm in danger of slipping or falling. Oh Lord, do not let me go into danger. Let me not miss my way. Let me not put myself in a situation where I'm going to be endangered. Keep me. But also deliver me. This is the language of rescue. This is the language of being brought out of danger, less perhaps of being kept from going into danger. So here's a man who not only knows his own weakness and folly, but he knows the strength and the malice of his enemies. There are people who are against him because he is a follower of Jehovah. And there's a danger then that they will attack him and that they will destroy him. And perhaps again, you know what it's like to be in a situation in your family, in your workplace, in some group, where the more distinctly you are known as a Christian, the more there seem to be particular people who are ready to jump on you and bring you down. It's as if raising the flag of Jesus Christ makes people determined to expose you as some kind of a fraud. There are many who are opposed, says David, to everything that I stand for and all that I want to be and do. Oh Lord, don't just keep me from stumbling into this danger myself. But when danger comes upon me, when the net is spread for me, oh Lord, you deliver me. It's a very simple but very comprehensive way of covering all the territory, isn't it? Keep me, because I am weak and foolish. Deliver me, because they are strong and malicious. O Lord, take care of me. You can pray like this with regard to temptation against towards sin. Isn't this what we need to pray in our weakness, in our folly? When temptation rolls in upon us, when we begin to play with the poison, to engage with something that will lead eventually to sin, and we know the trigger points, we know if we go down this route that we're going to be in a place of danger, and before we even start we need to be praying, Lord, keep me. Or temptation rushes in upon us, the assault comes in from the wicked one, something we'd not expected is dandled before our eyes or is beginning to well up in our hearts, and we're praying, oh Lord, deliver me, don't let this overcome me. It may be confusion with regard to the truth. Lord, don't let me go into error. Let me not wander into ways of falsehood. When somebody tells me something and it's not true, help me to be able to discern that, O God, that my mind and my heart might not be turned away from you. Keep me and deliver me from suspicion of you, O God. Isn't that what so often cripples us? We actually don't believe that God is as good or as great as we've even read him to be in the Psalms that we've considered this morning. You are good, O Lord. But there's something inside that's like, is that so? If God were really good or really great, that's what you're asking. Why would he put me in this position? David says, keep me from that, O God. Let me not doubt you. Deliver me from every suggestion, every satanic influence that would ask in effect, as God really said that this is what he will do, as God really made himself known like this. Maybe the affliction of enemies. You feel the weight of David's grief. Consider my enemies, for they are many and they hate me. Not just with an ordinary hatred, but with cruel hatred. Go back to the opening verses. Let those who deal treacherously without cause be ashamed. David was a man who knew what it is to seek to do good to others. And in response, he got this vindictiveness and this aggression. They have no reason for hating him, and yet their treachery is without cause. The corruption of my own heart. Lord, keep me from that. Let me not go into paths of wickedness, but lead me in the way of righteousness. When I'm tempted, like the pilgrim in Pilgrim's Progress, when Christian sees the ways off, when people are enticing him to take a different route, oh Lord, let me go on the straight and narrow path. Keep me from error and deliver me from those who would divert me or drive me off the way of truth. And ultimately, perhaps, Lord, keep me from hell and deliver me from the wrath which is to come. Because as a sinner, that's what I deserve. As one who is by nature full of corruption and transgression. Oh, Lord, if you don't save me, I am lost. Here then is a man who, because of the weakness of his own body and soul, because of the strength and the malice of everyone and everything that opposes him, asks God to be his lifesaver. Keep me and preserve me. What's the dreadful alternative to God upholding and preserving his child? Let me not be ashamed. This is the fall that he dreads from the very beginning. Again, go back to the first three verses. Hear the concentration and the repetition. To you, O Lord, I lift up my soul. O my God, I trust in you. Let me not be ashamed. What does that mean, David? Let not my enemies triumph over me. Indeed, he broadens it out. Let no one who waits on you be ashamed. Let those be ashamed who deal treacherously without cause. Verse 19. Consider my enemies, for they are many, and they hate me with cruel hatred. There's this principled antagonism against me. As a follower of God, says David, there are many who seek my stumbling. Many who'd just be happy to see me exposed. Many who are ready to gloat over my downfall. Therefore, let me not be ashamed. That's what will happen if you don't keep me and preserve me. Now, what does it mean to be ashamed? Because it's not here just your personal reputation. Some of us are far, far too concerned about the way that other people perceive us. It's the fear of man and it cripples us. And that's not David's primary concern here. When he prays, let me not be ashamed, let not my enemies triumph over me, he's not just asking that he himself wouldn't in some way be exposed. It's a bigger, more substantial concern. It's David's credibility as a true man of God and as one who is depending upon the Lord himself. It's David as a man who has made common cause with Jehovah. It's David as a follower of God. It's you and me as those who have made it plain that we follow Jesus Christ himself, that we are trusting in him, that we will walk in his ways, that our lives will reflect that conviction, that attachment, that union with Jesus Christ. Many of you will have heard when we have baptized people here before us use the illustration that this is the day when we nail our colours to the mast. When we are baptized, it is a declaration of faith. It is a public testimony that I have died with Jesus Christ and I have risen again to newness of life, that I am his and that he is mine. It's your way of saying, from this point on, in dependence upon God, my life will reflect His law. It is written in my heart, I desire His glory. Every decision I make, every step I take, every word I speak, I want it to be something that says I belong to God and to His Christ. And because of the life that is in me, this is the life that I will live out in the world. And David is saying, in effect, that having made such a declaration, having been seen and known as God's man, that the carpet wouldn't be pulled out from underneath him. Have you ever trodden on something that's given way underneath you? Perhaps you've been walking through an old house, or you've found a barn somewhere. Perhaps you've gone out on the ice. You hear it creaking. Sometimes, I don't know if you can hear it now, sometimes this platform creaks. All these different panels on it. I've got little bits of rubber, and underneath the panels there are these great big iron bars. Now, even without the iron bars or the steel bars, these panels should not give way. But what if you walked up on here? Anybody who's been up here, you step up, you expect everything to hold you. What if it gave way underneath you? What if you were out on the ice and all of a sudden it collapses beneath you? What if you walk across that wooden floor and all of a sudden the floorboards splinter? That's what it means to be ashamed. You thought you could trust something and it's let you down. Perhaps you know what it is to rely upon somebody. Somebody gives you an assurance, I will help you, I will make this contribution, I will do these things. People make vows to one another. And then in the moment of tension, in the moment of need, it's like the prophet says, you leant on it and it was a rotten staff. It didn't only crumble under your weight, but the splinters went into your hand. David says, Lord, when I put my foot on the rock, let not the rock give way underneath me. I'm going to rest my weight on something. Oh Lord, let not that let me down so that I am brought low. And you see then, it's not so much about David in himself. It is David in relationship to his God. That's where the shame, the embarrassment, the exposure, the sense of being let down might come in. Because David is saying, oh Lord, if I fall, then it's your name that will be disdained and despised. They will rub their hands over me and say, in effect, to use the language that our Lord picked up, he called upon the name of the Lord, he trusted in God, let God now deliver him. And David's saying, oh Lord, you keep me, you deliver me, let me not be ashamed. Don't make my trust in you appear to be an empty, foolish, worthless thing. I've rested my weight upon you. Oh God, you uphold me. I've set my foot upon the rock. Prove a rock indeed in this life. My faith is going to be ridiculed. My faith is going to be assaulted. Oh Lord, let it not be exposed as an empty and worthless thing. Let me not be brought to public disgrace as a follower of the one true God. Yes, they may despise me because of you. They may hate me on account of my faithfulness to you. But prove yourself my God. Do not let me be ashamed. Don't let them say, ha, God has forsaken him. God has abandoned him. God is nothing, this God in whom he trusted. You see, if David was only concerned about his own public reputation, would he be saying, for your name's sake, O Lord, pardon my iniquity, for it is great. Perhaps we hate the idea of our sins being exposed. The people knowing that we're actually not the kind of people we'd like to pretend that we really are. For David, that's something that he can boast in. For your name's sake, O Lord, pardon my iniquity, for it is great. It is as a sinner trusting in God that he has anything to boast about. Yes, I am weak, but God is strong. I am a sinner, but here is a Saviour. I am a transgressor, but here is the law giver, and here is the one who can blot out all my transgressions. I'm trusting in him. I'm relying upon him. Oh Lord, let me not be ashamed. It's a display of salvation that David seeks, that the godless would not triumph over him. It's a good prayer for us as individuals, isn't it? Lord, let me not be ashamed. As I go through this world as a follower of Jesus Christ, don't let that confident expectation, don't let my boast of you be brought to nothing in the eyes of the world. And it's a prayer for a congregation. Don't you love the way David begins to open it up? He did it at the beginning. He did it at the end. Verse 3, let no one who waits on you be ashamed. Verse 22, redeem Israel, O God, out of all their troubles. This is a prayer for you, brother, for you, sister, as you make your way through this difficult and dangerous environment when there are many around you who are quite happy to see your confidence in Christ be proved worthless and empty, so that your principles and your practices are made to appear foolish and pointless. People who would love to see you in life and at death with nothing left to hang on to. Oh Lord, let me not be ashamed. What of the church of Jesus Christ? What of the things that we believe? What of the gospel that we preach? What of the confidence that we have? What of the service that we render? What of the work that we do? What of the love that we show? What of the duties that we embrace? The world thinks it's a nonsense. Pointless, empty, powerless, worthless. Oh Lord, let me not be ashamed. Let none of those who wait upon you be ashamed. Oh God, may our confidence in you be proved. Though all seems lost in the world, do not forsake me, but keep me and preserve me, that I not be ashamed. What is the sure foundation of such prayers? For I put my trust in you. For I put my trust in you. Now, if we're honest with ourselves, our instinctive idolatry is staggering. John Calvin famously said, right toward the beginning of his Institutes of the Christian Religion, that the heart of man is a factory of idols. We keep producing something other than God in which to trust. Our instinct is to worship. Our instinct is to rely. Our instinct is to depend. In all our boasting, we still know that we need something to hold us up. And so we keep producing something. Brothers and sisters, even as believers, idols can sneak back in to our hearts. And we've come to the point where we've got a Christ plus, a God plus, something else, something perhaps first. Christ just becomes some kind of safety net. But it's my wisdom, it's my strength, it's my resources, it's what I've got or someone I can rely upon. We are too quick to expect someone or something, ourselves or other things or people in this world, to be the help that we need in time of trouble. Here's a simple test. When something goes wrong, is your first instinct to bow the knee or to pick up the phone? To whom do you turn first? Now, if I saw an accident on the way home, the first thing I would do would be to call 999. Not what I'm talking about. But when the pressures come, when the distresses roll in, do we pour the tale of all our woes, to use William Cooper's language, into the ear of some fellow mortal? Or are we very quick to turn to God in prayer? I'm not saying it's always wrong or ever wrong to engage. We prayed earlier, didn't we, in the light of Ephesians 6 and James 5. We are to make supplication for all the saints. We are to pray for one another. We are to love one another in practical ways. And one of the things that we do is to tell people what we need in order that they can pray on our behalf. But what comes first and what dominates? For I put my trust in you. This is the language of a believer who is quite deliberately leaving aside other things in order to flee to God as his refuge. The troubles of my heart have enlarged. Bring me out of my distresses. Look on my affliction and my pain and forgive all my sins. Consider my enemies, for they are many, and they hate me with cruel hatred. Brings it all together. Oh Lord, keep me. Oh Lord, preserve me. Let me not be put to shame, because I am trusting in you. Now sometimes God in his mercy will do that for you. Have you ever been in a situation, and it's unpleasant when we first go into it, is it not? When all of our props start getting kicked away. All of the things that we instinctively rely upon are removed. I had a conversation recently with a wise man who said that God in his wisdom and mercy tends to deal with us at the very points of the things that we like to trust in that are not him. Is money the answer to everything? Well, perhaps God won't make you poor. Is it your physical strength? Or perhaps God will make you sick or weak. Is it your intellect? Perhaps God will darken your mind. Is it your relationships? And perhaps God will isolate you. Is it your counselors? And perhaps God will take them away. Is it the size of the church? And perhaps God will make you small. Is it the reputation that you have in the world as a Christian or as a congregation, then perhaps God will bring you low. Why? That you might learn that those things were never really your confidence. That those things were never really your joy. The things that you've built your hopes upon, the things that you expect will make you happy and fruitful and stable. And the Lord in his mercy, note, not because he hates you, not because he's angry with you, not because he wants to hurt you, but because he wants to bring you to himself that you may say with truth, "For I have not put my trust in those other things. I have learned their emptiness. And so my trust is in you." Sometimes God does that for us. Here I think we're being encouraged to do it for ourselves. Perhaps this is how we need to pray more. Perhaps we need a season of self-examination. Lord, I've trusted in this, but I will not trust in it anymore. I've relied upon that, but I will no longer make that my hope and my stay. This has been an anchor point for me, but it drifts when the storms come. I thought that I could rely upon that staff, but those staves break. I thought that I could set my foot upon this, but it's not rock, it's sinking sand. To go through some of the things that you are inclined to look to other than to God. And not to abandon them altogether, for some of them are very good and very blessed in their own place. But to say in effect, "Lord, not this, and not that, and not him, and not her, and not them, and not this. But you, O Lord, you are my trust." And this is not desperate doubt. This isn't everything else has failed me, so I'd better trust in God after all. No, this is confident hope. I trust you can feel the boldness of this boast. It's a little bit like a child who tells one of their friends when they see something, "Oh, my daddy could lift that. My daddy's got that covered. He can do this, he can do that." And perhaps you as a father, you overhear it and you think, I'm not so sure, but the child is absolutely confident. My daddy can push this, he can pull that, he can lift that, he can beat them, he can... There is this kind of bold confidence in the child of God. My father can bear my weight. My father can hold me up. My father can lift my soul. He can keep my soul. He can preserve me. He is able to stop me from being brought low. My confidence in him is not misplaced. And the boldness in this is that you are basically, in the best sense, putting God to the test. And perhaps there are some of you here this morning who need to do this with regard to your salvation. Because you're still, as it were, dancing around the cross and you haven't come to cling to the cross. Are you a Christian? I hope so. I think so. I may be. I'd like to imagine it. My friends, it's good and right for you to come and to say in effect, "Oh Lord, let me not be ashamed, for I put my trust in you. If you let me down, then you have ungodded yourself. If you don't save me in accordance with your promises, then as it were, the blame will rest at your feet." Do you know that God says over and over in his word, "Come to me, trust me, depend upon me, rely upon me. Don't just reach out a finger and hope that maybe some good will come. Throw your weight upon me and I will hold you up." And that's this language. Some of you need to come to Jesus like this. "Lord, I'm going to throw myself upon you. I have no other plea. And if I am damned, I will be damned trusting in Jesus." Now, how could that ever be? Is God going to let you down? Is God going to abandon the one who comes trusting in the blood of his beloved Son? Here's a bold faith for you. Here's a good example for you. "Oh Lord, keep my soul and preserve me. Let me not be ashamed, for I put my trust in you." And then all the burden rests upon God. In that sense, it's not my problem anymore. My life is hidden with Christ in God. I know whom I have believed. And I am persuaded that he is able to keep what I have committed to him until that day. See, I'm weak and foolish. I can't keep myself, but he can keep me. I have many strong and malicious enemies. They could bring me down, but no one can pluck me out of his hand. That's the faith that you and I need in coming to Jesus Christ. And it's the faith that God is pleased to give, and it's the faith that God himself sustains. And having come to Christ in this way, this is the way that we keep trusting. Not smuggling anything back into that relationship, but as you go on as an unashamed follower of Jesus Christ, to go on saying, "Keep me and preserve me. Let me not be ashamed, for I have put my trust in you." So my health and my strength and my home and my wealth and my job and my grades and my relationships and my sports and my hobbies and my reputation, yes, my very life itself, oh Lord, that is yours. I put it in your hands. And if I'm brought low, it must be because you were not God to me. It's your reputation that is at stake. I've made common cause with the Lord my God, and I'm expecting him to be true to his word. I have put my trust in you. You boys and girls, you ever boasted about what dad can do or what mum can do? Sooner or later, dad and mum let you down. However properly and affectionately you may appreciate us, we are weak and we are foolish and we will make mistakes and we will commit sins and we cannot be everything that we would want to be. But there is a Father in heaven who can be trusted absolutely and entirely. And he never lets down those who trust in him. Never puts to shame those who've rested their souls upon him. Oh, for such faith as this. To be able, with the whole of life, to say, not casually or flippantly or carelessly, oh, that's not my problem anymore, but to look up with reverence to God and to say, Lord, you keep me, you preserve me. Let me not be ashamed, for I have put my trust in you. The ship will go down. The ship of this world will go down. What conversation are you having on the tilting deck? What are you talking about? What are you taken up with? What bubbles to the surface in your conversation? My friends, if we are believers, then we ought to be living in a way that everybody knows we are Christ's people. It doesn't mean we need to be in everybody's faces all the times, singing happy, happy, joy, joy Christian choruses. But what I say and how I live, my principles and my priorities, my speech, my dress, my demeanour, the way I interact with my family and with my friends and with my neighbours and with my colleagues, ought to tell people that we are followers of the living God. I'm not to be ashamed of the fact that I am Christ's and Christ is mine. Who will be my lifesaver in such a world? God vindicated Jesus Christ as the covenant head when he trusted in him. They mocked him on the cross, remember? Where is your Jehovah now, Jesus of Nazareth? God testified that he was his son by raising him from the dead. The world despised him and forsook him. They saw no honour, no beauty, no glory in him. But God vindicated him, and he was not ashamed. And we, trusting in this Christ, trusting in him as the God of our salvation, we too have confidence. Do you notice that this psalm does not resolve with the enemies taken away, the sin swept to one side, the pains immediately and entirely removed, the afflictions simply dissolved? The resolution of this psalm is not the removal of all the threats. It's the reality of renewed faith. That's the peace at which this psalm arrives. And that's the peace with which we can leave this place this morning. Your circumstances may not have changed. You may have the same battles, the same challenges, the same difficulties, the same threats this coming week as you did last week. But our God does not change. Can you go now and pray, keep me, keep my soul, preserve my life. Let me not be ashamed, living or dying. For I have put my trust in you. My friends, our lives, our souls, our being in relation to God, that ought to be our chief concern. And when it is, this is the point of our faith, of our trust, of our love, and of our hope. He can keep you. He will deliver you. He will not let you be put to shame when you trust in him. Amen.